hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
We hear a lot about the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was a watershed civil rights law that helped to improve equality and fairness in voting, especially for people of color. But did you know that a few states have their own state voting rights acts? These laws have become extremely important in the fight for robust voting rights, especially as the U.S. Supreme Court has gutted the protections of the Federal Voting Rights Act. Here to discuss state voting rights acts, what they are, where they exist, and how we can advocate for their expansion is Lata Nat, a senior legal counsel and member of the voting rights team at the Campaign Legal Center. Lata, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us about the Campaign Legal Center, where you work. What does it do, and how did you arrive there?
The Campaign Legal Center, or CLC as we call it, it's a national nonpartisan organization that has the mission to advance democracy through litigation, policy work, research, providing support in all of those areas for folks on the ground in states. And the issues that we work on are campaign finance, ethics, redistricting, and my personal area, voting rights. And you asked how I got into this work. Well, I worked for another voting rights organization called State Voices before this. But before that, I worked in the First Amendment space, which is I loved it, but it was often very frustrating to me to see how courts protect the right to speak freely in a way that they just don't protect the right to vote. Even though, in my view, the two they're very interrelated. Political speech is the most protected form of speech because the idea is that political speech has the power to affect change. What is voting but the culmination of that? And yet it just isn't as protected as speech. So that's sort of what drew me to the space.
Yeah, and if you ask most Americans to name their most fundamental rights under the Constitution, they'd probably say free speech. They might say freedom of religion. But I think many would also say the right to vote. But as you said, we have less robust protection for that most fundamental right that underpins our democracy for voting. So your work, as I mentioned in the intro, has focused on state voting rights acts in particular. So how many states have these kinds of laws and what do they generally do?
Well, currently 7 states have these laws. In case you're wondering, they're California, Oregon, Washington, Virginia, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota. That adds up to 7, right? 7 states. And what they are is they're legislative packages of voting rights protections that push back against racial discrimination in voting and help to ensure that all voters in a state can exercise their right to vote.
So why do we need them? I mean, we have the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, which also seeks to protect minority voters and ensure equality in voting. So what's the point in having voting rights acts in these states as state-specific laws?
Well, do you mind if I kind of take the long way around with this answer?
Let's do it.
All right. So let's go back to the late 1860s. So we're backing up a lot. And this is the period after the Civil War that I'm talking about, when the Constitution is amended by the 13th Amendment to prohibit slavery. And then the 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law. And then the 15th Amendment says that government, that's the federal government and state governments, can't deny citizens the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, which is so great. But unfortunately, for many, many years, there's actually no enforcement mechanism for the 15th Amendment. So over the course of the next few decades, lots of states engage in practices that deny citizens the right to vote on the basis of race. They institute poll taxes, property ownership requirements to vote, literacy tests. They have a grandfather clause for anybody whose grandfather could vote, which, of course, excludes anyone whose grandfather was a slave. They draw district boundaries to make sure that voters of color can't elect candidates of their choice. And these are all laws and policies that are colorblind on their face, but they're designed to exclude Black citizens disproportionately. Because the 15th Amendment on its own doesn't have any guidance on what the federal government can do to make sure that states aren't denying the right to vote to people of color. It doesn't really define what it means to have your right to vote denied or abridged. And then the Federal Voting Rights Act is passed in 1965, and it does these things. It clarifies these things. It creates an enforcement mechanism for the right to vote because it allows the Federal Department of Justice and affected voters to like actually sue to challenge racially discriminatory laws and maps and election systems in court. And before 2013, it also required that certain states and jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination pre-clear any changes that they wanted to make to election laws and maps with the DOJ or a court, which essentially nipped a lot of racially discriminatory laws in the bud before they even went into effect. So all of this is great, but in 2013, the Supreme Court invalidated that part I just mentioned about pre-clearing provisions in jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination.
Yeah, this is the Shelby County decision.
Yes, exactly. This is not the only instance of the Supreme Court or federal courts in general diminishing the power of the federal VRA, because since 1965, when it was passed, there have been a lot of lawsuits and a lot of court decisions, and a body of law has emerged on how to decide these cases. And not all of it is very good for voters of color. The Supreme Court has set precedent that makes it extremely challenging for plaintiffs to prevail in these cases. They have set precedent that this is the thing that makes me mad. There's precedent that says that if you do manage to win one of these cases, then the court should defer to the government that violated your rights in the first place on what kind of remedy they should put in place.
The very people who violated it all along get to try to fix it themselves.
Yes, the losing party gets to pick the solution. And all of this just kind of emerged in federal case law. The Supreme Court, in addition to the Shelby County decision in 2021, they also made it really hard to prevail in a case for voter suppression. That case is called Brnovich v. DNC.
That one really, I think, is a good example of the Supreme Court really going out of its way to harm the Federal Voting Rights Act when Justice Alito, in that majority opinion, creates these five so-called guideposts that plaintiffs have to satisfy to win a case under the Voting Rights Act. And every single one of them is difficult for plaintiffs to satisfy. None are neutral of those five guideposts that he comes up with kind of out of thin air, right?
Right. And not only are they difficult for plaintiffs to satisfy, some of them are, I would say all of them, but I can at least say that they're inane. They're not related to whether voters are suffering racial discrimination in voting or not, which is the entire crux of the matter. For instance, one of them is weighs against the plaintiffs if the law that they're challenging was really prevalent in 1982 when the Federal Voting Rights Act was reauthorized or amended. What that has nothing to do with whether that law is racially discriminatory or has a racially discriminatory effect.
Yeah. So basically, your point here is that states need to step up to enact their own robust state Voting Rights Act, because even though we have a federal one, the Supreme Court has, chipped away at its protections to the point where the Federal Voting Rights Act is not as effective as it once was. Is that a fair summary?
That is a fair summary. And I'd also say that a state Voting Rights Act can restore the protections of the Federal Voting Rights Act. It can also improve on them, because there were things that the drafters of the original Federal Voting Rights Act didn't really take into account when it was passed in 1965. States can tailor Voting Rights Act to take into account their specific circumstances and their specific concerns, and honestly introduce provisions that improve on the act. For example, in a state Voting Rights Act, you can have a provision that requires a prospective plaintiff and the local government to meet and negotiate a solution before they proceed to litigation. On the Federal Voting Rights Act, it's just straight to a lawsuit. There's no other way to get relief from whatever from whatever law or policy is making it hard for minority voters to vote.
So I was thinking about the list of states that you mentioned that have passed these laws, the State Voting Rights Act, and you said seven have enacted them. And when you listed them, they all sound like so-called blue states. They all sound like states that Democrats have controlled the legislatures, the electoral votes for president. Typically, the Democrat wins those states: California, New York, Oregon, etc. So, is this just an idea to help Democrats?
No, I would say actually that since these have been passed in Democratic states, the local government officials that are often being sued, if Democrats are in control, sometimes they're going to be Democrats. This is a tool that voters can use to challenge any type of partisan government, whether it's a Democratic government or a Republican government, to enforce their own right to vote.
What do you make of the fact that these are all blue states, that they've not been passed in so-called red states yet?
State voting rights acts have been introduced in what we would consider more red states, most recently in Florida. And it's tough. It's not a friendly political environment for that bill right now. And it really is there to serve as sort of like an organizing vehicle, something that folks can rally around, even if they don't think it's going to pass anytime soon. It's something that they can say, this is what we want. This is ideally what we need in this state, even if our politicians don't really think so right now. I think that voting has become very politicized. It's hard to remember that in 2006, the federal VRA was reauthorized with huge bipartisan support. It passed unanimously in the Senate. And now it's always seen as voting rights are considered sort of a Democratic power grab and not really something that that Republicans are often in favor of, which is sad and wasn't necessarily always the case. These state voting rights acts aren't a Democratic push because they actually don't push any specific policy. They just give voters of color, minority voters from historically disenfranchised groups, it gives them the tools to challenge racially discriminatory laws and policies in whatever form they take. That doesn't target a specific party, unless, of course, like a party passes a lot of racially discriminatory laws, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's basically just a way for voters to assert their own rights, not to favor a particular party.
So you noted that the U.S. Supreme Court and lower federal courts have really harmed the strength of the Federal Voting Rights Act, issuing rulings that have chipped away at the power of the Voting Rights Act to make it harder for plaintiffs to bring cases under the federal law. What's to stop state courts from doing the same thing to these new state voting rights acts?
Well, we write them very carefully. We write them with the knowledge that we have from decades of federal court decisions and interpretations that have been harmful to the original intent of the Federal Voting Rights Act. For example, I mentioned earlier that one of the federal court interpretations of the Federal Voting Rights Act that makes me really mad is the idea that the government that put the racially discriminatory law or policy into place in the first place has the first choice and deference of the court as to how to remedy that. In all of the state VRAs that I have worked on, there's always an explicit provision that says the court should consider every remedy proposed by all interested parties and pick the one that is most suited to solve the problem. That sounds simple and kind of obvious, but we have said that explicitly. There is no wiggle room for interpretation around that. And I think these are drafted to essentially address all of the things that we see as shortcomings in how the federal VRA has been interpreted.
So, you know, one interesting aspect of this is demonstrating the power of states to pass laws and to try them out and see how they work. We've seen this in other reforms like ranked choice voting that started at the local level, spread to a couple states, and now being moved into additional states, including a state like Nevada, which is going to vote on ranked choice voting for a second time this year. And if it passes second time, Nevada will move to ranked choice voting for statewide elections. It also passed a voter's bill of rights. Nevada first passed that as a law through its legislature, and then it enshrined a voter's bill of rights in the Nevada Constitution. Is that something also that we should consider? And how do we make that broader push beyond just a state voting rights act, but for a stronger protection for voters within state constitutions?
Oh, I absolutely think that the Nevada Voters Bill of Rights, it's a great thing. It's unambiguously a great thing when a state enshrines the right to vote in its own constitution. I think the Nevada Voters Bill of Rights contains some specific protections for voters, and also just generally says that every voter has the right to access to election systems without discrimination. And that's wonderful. And that is something that I would hope that every state constitution would contain. I think that what is significant about state voting rights acts is that these sort of, it's the same thing as I was saying earlier about how you have the 15th Amendment to our U.S. Constitution that says everyone has the right to vote and governments can't deny it based on race. And then that doesn't mean a lot unless you have guidelines for how to implement that. And so like a broad protection in a state constitution is fantastic. And it means that the state is protecting the right to vote more than our federal constitution does. But a state VRA, I see them going hand in hand because the state VRA sort of like interprets like, well, this is how that works.
What about Congress fixing it? You know, there's been the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that's been proposed in Congress to respond to the Supreme Court's decisions. That's continually failed to pass. And again, it's been seen as just a Democratic push. You know, how could we get that law passed and would it fix the problem?
Well, my organization is engaged in efforts to get Congress to pass, to reauthorize the federal VRA, which would restore its preclearance provisions and would be wonderful. In our view, advocacy for state VRAs goes hand in hand with this work. State VRAs aren't a replacement for reauthorizing the federal VRA. For example, state VRAs generally apply to local governments, while the federal VRA covers state governments. But we think that it's good for voters to have federal and state court options for enforcing their own rights. And of course, state voting rights acts can be written to provide more protections for voters than the federal VRA. At the same time, the federal VRA, that means that states that are unlikely to vote to pass their own state VRAs will be covered. And federal VRAs also apply to state governments, whereas state VRAs often only apply to local governments. So I think both of them are really important. And I don't think one is a replacement for the other.
Are you optimistic about voting and elections? You know, we talked about how the Supreme Court has done so much harm with respect to the Federal Voting Rights Act. So does that make you a pessimist or are you an optimist?
I do not think that I could do the work that I do if I wasn't an optimist.
And what makes you optimistic?
I think that this is slow and hard work and that there are setbacks. But if you just look at the last 100 years, there's setbacks, there's great leaps forward. It's never a battle that's won indefinitely. We used to say this in the First Amendment world that the First Amendment is never safe and secure. It's always in the process of being made safe and secure. And I feel like that's true of democracy in general. And so I'm an optimist. I feel like we're always trying to move forward. We're always trying to protect this thing that we have, this democracy. And if there are setbacks, that doesn't mean that they are permanent setbacks. It's never over.
Why should people vote? What's the point of voting in your view?
Well, it's a direct way to affect changes in your government, which affect so many aspects of your life. I live in Washington, D.C., where, you know, we don't have our own senators. And there's often this feeling that, oh, well, our vote doesn't matter. I mean, obviously, we're not a swing state. But I don't think that's true. I think that there's always a level of government where your vote does matter. And even if maybe we are not we're not the place that a presidential candidate would go and campaign, but we have a robust local government that makes so many decisions that affect our lives, and it's important for us to have our voices heard and to have that government reflect us.
Latha Knott is the senior legal counsel and a member of the voting rights team at the Campaign Legal Center, focusing in particular on state voting rights acts. Latha, thanks so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Josh, as states pass voting rights laws, is it a given? Do we just
pretty much assume that there are going to be lawsuits about the constitutionality of those laws?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I sometimes say what's bad for the country is good for me, and things have been way too good with respect to the increase of lawsuits. And that's what happened in Washington State. The legislature there passed the Washington Voting Rights Act in 2018, aiming to protect minority groups from voter discrimination. Plaintiffs used the law to seek changes to electoral structures, such as in Franklin County. Previously, each of Franklin's three county commissioners were elected in a countywide vote, which let the white majority control all three seats, even though the county has a sizable Latino population. The settlement agreement that stemmed from this lawsuit divided the county into three separate districts and now allows for voters from each district to elect their own commissioner. Under the previous system, the Latino population, accounting for almost 50% of the total county population, was underrepresented on the commission and struggled to rally enough voters to elect their preferred candidates. Now, Latino voters can come together in a district where they live to elect their candidate of choice. But James Jimenez, a Republican commissioner from Franklin County, intervened in this lawsuit to challenge the state's Voting Rights Act. He argued that the law improperly requires courts to consider race as the predominant factor in redistricting, in violation of both the U.S. and state constitutions. The case went to the Washington Supreme Court, which rejected his challenge. The court wrote that the law, quote, protects all Washington voters from discrimination on the basis of race, color, and language minority group. Jimenez then sought review at the U.S. Supreme Court, but in April of this year, the court declined to take the case. That means that the Washington Voting Rights Act remains the law, and the Franklin County settlement will take effect beginning for the 2024 election cycle. It just goes to show the tangible impact of state voting rights laws.
You know, we hear all the time that we should contact our representative when we have a beef with the government or something we'd like to call to their attention. It seems easier said than done, though. How can we do that effectively, really get through?
Yeah, you know, the federal government has a great resource at usa.gov/elected-officials where you can input your address and then be given information about all of your representatives, their party affiliation, office address, office phone number, website, and social media accounts. It's separated into three tabs: federal, state, and local officials. The page has this info for President Biden, all the way down to your city and county officials. So could it be any easier to contact your local election officials? Well, maybe. In 2017, a nonpartisan organization called ResistBot entered the scene and immediately began making waves. It's a free text-based service that allows users in the United States to compose and send letters to their elected officials in just minutes. Users access the service by sending a message to ResistBot via text message or another messaging platform. ResistBot will respond, asking for their address to determine who represents them. Next, the user can either manually type out the message they want forwarded to their representatives or simply provide ResistBot with a bill number or link to an article concerning an issue they care about, and ResistBot's AI will draft a message for them. ResistBot will deliver the message via electronic delivery, fax, or postal mail, depending on which methods are available. According to its website, ResistBot has sent over 31 million letters from over 9.8 million users. Of course, this service hasn't come without its fair share of criticism. As one Vox journalist said of ResistBot and similar organizations, these services and technologies are cheapening the meaning of civic engagement by turning it into a commodity. In addition, many elected officials' offices on the receiving end of ResistBot's letters lack the proper resources to handle such high levels of automated communications. For better or worse, ResistBot and services like it have certainly altered the future of contacting representatives.
Well, after hearing that, big question, what's something we can do to support democracy?
Well, as you know, I'm a big fan of civic engagement, and though we mentioned it already, I want to repeat those resources so you can find your representatives and have their contact information. Go to usa.gov/elected-officials. It's pretty cool. I put in my own address, and it gave me the contact info not only for the president, but also my local council member and county clerk. So here's an idea for our listeners. Think of the voting rights issue that you find most important. Perhaps it's a state's Voting Rights Act or some other law, and contact your state representative about it. You could also try ResistBot, as I mentioned previously. Send the word resist to 50409 via text message, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Instagram, DM, or Telegram, and answer the questions texted back. Within minutes, ResistBot's automated system will be able to use your inputs to contact your local elected officials on your behalf.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU. Big wide open skies for your big wide open eyes. Keep it real, now, don't you tell me. If the slate is clean, I'm gonna read my books, I'm gonna wrap them up tight. I can educate myself on the fight.